regarding this is Senate Committee on Commerce. And let's see, we're going to be starting off, first of all, with an informational meeting. And at this point, what I'd like to do is ask, well, that was actually what we took off.
Oh, that was the old agenda.
I do have the old agenda. Okay, I'll use this one. How about if we start over here? Calling the order at this point of the Senate Commerce Committee, and we have a couple of bills or a few bills that we have set for a public hearing and possible work session. What I'd like to do at this point is ask for the witness list for those who are going to be testifying. And I guess, Mr. Gardner, I assume you're here to testify on all of the bills?
Yes, sir.
What I think I'm going to go ahead and do is then go ahead and open a public hearing on the following bills: SB 136, SB 137, SB 138, and SB 145. This will allow Commissioner Gardner to give his testimony, and then we will pick up with additional testimony for those who are here who may be here only to testify on one of those bills. These are the bills that we have currently scheduled for today for public hearing and possible work session. So, again, I have opened the public hearing, and Mr. Gardner, with you and your entourage, feel free to cover the areas that you'd like, and just please identify for the record not only your name and such, but also which bill you are giving testimony on so we can have a record that reflects that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner. I'm the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. With me is Mark Sultan, my legislative liaison, and Christy Hammond, the head of the Wage and Hour Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And let me just start with Senate Bill 136, which it simply deletes a reference under the state's prevailing wage law dealing with flaggers. It's simply an obsolete reference, and I'll let Christy explain some of the mechanics of how that works.
For the record, my name is Christine Hammond. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. As Commissioner Gardner indicates, Senate Bill 136 is primarily a housekeeping bill. Prior to the year 1995, the federal Davis-Bacon Act, which is the federal counterpart to the state prevailing wage rate law, did not cover flaggers on federal public works projects. The Oregon legislature enacted legislation that would cover flaggers employed on federal projects under the state prevailing wage rate law. As of 1995, the federal Davis-Bacon Act did cover flaggers, and the reference in ORS 279 covering flaggers under the state law is no longer required because they are covered under federal law. If it's a state project, our own state prevailing wage rate law would cover the flaggers. This was just to cover those flaggers that were not covered on federal projects.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on Senate Bill 137, it's also a housekeeping bill, which is to delete an obsolete reference dealing with minors, those under the age of 18. In the statute under 653.315, it says that minors should take their meal periods at noon. Actually, under current law, you're allowed a 30-minute unpaid lunch break, a 30 minutes unbroken, relieved of all duties. If you're working an 8-hour shift, for instance, state law for all workers says that you should take the lunch break no earlier than the third hour nor later than the fifth. And we don't enforce the reference that it says that minors should have their lunch break at noon, actually, as long as they follow the same law as all of their workers. Whether they take it at 11:30 or 1:30, or it doesn't even exempt, for example, take into consideration what if you're working an early shift or a late shift during the summertime, if you're working third shift. It's an obsolete reference that doesn't need to be in the statute, just the Bureau's minor effort at cleaning up unneeded and unenforceable statutes. We don't currently enforce this particular reference.
All right. Why don't you continue with the next one? We'll come back and ask questions on each of these that committee members may have for you and your staff.
And joining me is Annette Talbot, Deputy Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on Senate Bill 138, This bill simply refers to a specific period where an employee can get their employee records from their employer. Current law says that they're allowed to do so, but current law does not take into consideration a certain time frame of doing so, nor are there any penalties for failure to do so in current law. We get a number of complaints every single year. I believe the figure is 117 over the last two fiscal years. All we're able to do for those employees is to send a letter to the employer stating what current law is and asking the employer to do so, and simply being able to tell the employee that we don't enforce on this particular one, that they would have to hire a private attorney and privately go out to get those records from the employer. By establishing this into the section of law, it would give us the ability to go ahead and make sure that the employee does get the records. It'll also, most people don't know a lot about our technical assistant unit for employers. We have a unit actually totally self-supporting that goes out all over the state and puts on technical assistance seminars on all aspects of employment law for employers. We actually have an answering line of a number of people every day. We get thousands of phone calls every year answering questions for employers. What we intend to do, should this legislation pass, is make this part of our technical assistance for employers seminar, make sure that we get notices out to employers that this is law, how it works, how it establishes. Through the wage and hour division, particularly, our emphasis is not of that of using a hammer, if you will, as much as it is trying to get the employer into compliance. For instance, on meals and rest periods, we get a number of complaints every single year from employees that their employer isn't. Our first stance is to go talk to the employers, send them a demand letter, make sure that they have an opportunity to get into compliance within the law, rather than establishing, you know, a pattern or practice of fining. We don't fine until there's at least three cases where the employer has not gotten into compliance, where basically they have, you know, if you will, snub their nose at the law, and then you have to go absolutely make sure that they understand that we do have those authorities. It's better, much better, to try and work with the employer to make sure that they do understand the law and get into compliance voluntarily. And that's our intent with this. And I don't know if Ned had anything particularly to add or...
Mr. Chair, Ned Talbot, Deputy Labor Commissioner, for the record. We have put in what we think is a fairly reasonable amount of time, 45 days. We had an internal debate. Certainly we have employees that we have to provide personnel files for as well. So 45 days seem like a significant amount of time that an employer would have to either provide the document for the employee to look at or to copy it if necessary, if that's what the request was. We also allow for them to agree to mutually extend that time frame, because there are times where those records may or may not be available for some reason. So we wanted to provide that flexibility in the statute. And then, as the commissioner has already said, if and when someone just completely sort of willfully fails to provide a personnel file, we could impose a civil penalty. But we believe that with significant educational outreach to the employer community, that compliance will be very high, because I think for the most part, most employers are trying to do the right thing, and this is just hopefully an oversight where you have a right without a remedy, and we're proposing a remedy.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, that brings us to Senate Bill 145, which is clarification of a release of confidential records under statute. Currently, we work with the Employment Department in order to work records that we need to work on mutual cases. And basically, this is at the recommendation of the Attorney General's office that we do a clarification to statute to allow us to do that. All records within this are kept extremely confidential. There are many number of federal and state laws that keep employment records confidential. It would not get any of the public record statutes. It just allows interagencies to work better together and have that statutory clarity.
Mr. Chair, if I might, again, Annette Talbot for the record. We have worked with the Employment Department. They have a generic section you'll see in Section 1 of the bill that allows them to release other public employees in the performance of their public duties. So they do provide that information to us now. What they would like is a clarification that for all of the duties that the Bureau has, including wage and hour and civil rights, that we do have that authority. So it really would just codify the current practice. In many ways, it will help employers for us to verify that what they're telling us it jives with exact what the official records say as well. So it helps us verify what we're hearing within that those kinds of investigations. And we do take the information in terms of confidentiality very seriously. It is cloaked in confidentiality, even though we're getting it from them. In fact, our employees are required to sign a form that says they can be fired if they release the information. So we take that confidentiality issue very seriously, as does the Employment Department, and don't release the information, as the Commissioner said.
All right. Thank you. Do you have any other comments or testimony at this point on any of the bills that you've testified to at this point?
No, Mr. Chair. We're just ready to answer any questions any of the yourself or any of the committee members may have.
Okay. I think what I'm going to do as the Chair, I'm going to ask for committee members to, we'll go through the bills. I think after hearing your testimony, it might have been easier for us to take questions after each one. So what I'm going to do is ask committee members, first of all, if they have any questions dealing with the first bill we heard testimony, SB 136. This, again, basically would change and delete language in subsection, in Section 1, taking out the state Little Davis-Bacon language and allowing for, I would assume, the prevailing wage, depending on how the project is listed, to be paid to the flagger either under the state Little Davis-Bacon or the federal Davis-Bacon prevailing wage based on the project itself.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it would be either one depending on which one is, you know, how the project's funded and which it's determined to be.
All right. And do we have any other questions or clarifications for Senate Bill 136? And if not, then 137, committee members, if you have any questions. My understanding from this, there's still a restriction as to when that lunch hour actually takes place, or that half hour, whatever that time might be, within the third and fifth hour. But it would not mandate that employees that are under the age of 16 being required to take a lunch break at noon.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct. They would still fall under all of the other criteria of state law that every other employee falls under as far as eligibility for their lunch period.
So on, for the record, we wouldn't have a child or someone that's under 16 maybe going to work at 7 and not getting a lunch break until 3 or 4. They would have to fall within the same criteria as all other workers.
Yes, Mr. Chair, absolutely they would.
Any questions regarding Senate Bill 137? If not, then on Senate Bill 138, the only are there any questions from the committee members? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. On the new subsection 4, starting line 22 to line 25 on the bill, I guess I'm curious, you know, how is it going to make that ever work? As an employer, I'm trying to figure out first if an employee is requesting employee employment records, it's probably going to be an actor only, you know, it's not going to be a real nice conversation. There's probably something going on there. So how is it that you're ever going to get into an agreement that, and on what terms would require, you know, an extension agreement? I just can't figure out how you're going to get to a mutual agreement on that when the employee knows that if they say, no, I don't want an extension, then if there's a hammer, it creates a worse situation for the employer.
Well, Mr. Chair, or Representative, or Senator Beyer, excuse me, I got to remember which chamber I'm in here. Not used to this. Anyway, basically how it will work, as an employer ourselves, as the Bureau of Labor and Industries, 45 days is a very long period of time. Normally, what you're talking about with an employee's records is getting a personnel file, walking to a copy machine, and photocopying it, or coming to, you know, if they want an actual copy of it. If they want to just view the file, coming to a mutually agreeable time to do so. a 45-day period to do so normally in and of itself would be fine without that. You would only take for exceptional circumstances when it would take a time period to extend it. For instance, if the employee had come in to view their record and they had for some reason not made the appointment, they would mutually agree to make it later than that. That kind of a mutual agreement could be made. There is, with the Bureau, we're not about trying to force, civil penalties or any type of penalty through the Wage and Hour Division on the employer. What we want to do is see that they're in compliance. I don't know why it would take any employer longer than 45 days under most normal circumstances to be able to provide those records.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess the point is that in that scenario, that you set an appointment, and I don't, I'm just trying to figure out how this would ever work, this subsection, because if all the incentive for the employee would be to, okay, I missed the first appointment after 14 days, I missed the second appointment after 21 days, I missed the third appointment after 30 days, I missed the fifth appointment at 45 days, I now have a case where I can go get the employer and try to get civil penalties enforced on him, because it's with this language, when both have to mutually agree to an extension, the employee has all the incentive to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer. However, the penalty is discretionary upon the part of the Bureau, and I can absolutely guarantee you in that scenario where an employee is trying to do that, we would not enforce that civil penalty in any way, shape, or form. It's a matter, as far as the Bureau is concerned, of being fair to both sides. If an employee has missed three or four appointments, they've not made a good faith effort in order to meet both criteria. They wouldn't need a mutual agreement for that. The Bureau would not enforce a civil penalty.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that from this commissioner, but there are term limits on the commissioner.
Actually, Mr. Chair, Senator Byrd, no, sir, there is not.
All right.
You won't always.
Only on
time.
Yeah.
He still won't be here all the time.
Okay, but this, that may be your opinion you will not enforce, but that nowhere in it, in the statute, it doesn't say that if the employee misses appointments to see the records, or doesn't accept certified copies of the records to be sent to them, or whatever else you could do. That doesn't say that here. It says that if you get beyond 45 days, both sides have to mutually agree to an extension. And when all the incentive is for the employee to not do it and create a hassle for the employer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I think that my sense with employers with employees is they really want to see the record. That's why they're asking. There's some employment dispute, and oftentimes they have contacted an attorney, and the issue for them is reviewing their personnel record to see if the attorney is going to take their case. For those of you who are attorneys on the panel, attorneys will look at a case, an employee will come in and describe the situation to them. And the best thing for an employer, and a plaintiff attorney to do is to look at the personnel file before they decide to take the case. Because what might look like a great case on the face of it, when you see the personnel files, they have loads of personnel problems, might not look like such a good case. So it's in the employee's interest to show up and get the file. That's really what they want. And I would say that I think that that's why we bring this bill to you today, because we find that employees tell us that they either don't have the legal resources to hire an attorney to help them get the file, or attorneys tell us they actually have to file a lawsuit, which arguably is a waste of judicial resources, just to get the file to see what's going on. So I think everybody has the desire to actually see the file. So in terms of your scenario of them putting off appointments, I'm not sure that would be in the employee's best interest. Usually they want to actually see what the file says so that they can proceed either with maybe having some kind of dispute with their employer or just moving on with their life. And so that's really what the bill is trying to facilitate.
Senator Beyer, you want to continue?
Yeah, I got it. I guess under Section 2, it says, in addition to any other penalty provided by law, then it goes into to grant the civil penalty authority beyond that. I don't know what other penalties are provided by law currently without civil penalties.
Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, there are no other existing penalties for purposes of enforcement of Section 1 of the bill, which relates to the personnel records. So that's why we're here today. That penalty section, Mr. Chair, refers to penalties for a variety of different wage and hour violations. So it applies outside of the context of this personnel record. But there are no existing penalties for failure to either to not disclose a personnel record.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, if I could add, it's, as I said earlier in my statement, the only remedy for an employee is to hire an attorney and actually go to court to get the records.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I recognize that, but it says that there are the penalties prior to law, and I want to know what those were, even because my bringing, I didn't check those other statutes that are listed, so I didn't know if that was going to cross-reference someplace in that.
All right. Thank you. I have Senator Wissett next, and then followed by Senator Ringo.
Chair Brzezinski and Director Gardner. You said, I believe you said that there was 117 cases of noncompliance during the last biennium. How many of those cases complied with your request voluntarily?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Witt said there were 117 complaints for which we sent out letters stating to those employers, you know, what the law is and, you know, their need to comply. We don't track how many of them actually gave those records because we tell the employee all we can do is send out that letter. And beyond that, if they don't comply, their only recourse is to hire a private attorney and take that particular employer to court. So we don't actually track how many of those are, sir.
Mr. Chair, then it would be fair to characterize that you really don't know how badly you need this legislation because you really don't know how many companies or employers did not comply.
Mr. Chair, Senator Witsit, actually we know that 117 of them had to come to the Bureau of Labor and Industries in order to seek some sort of remedy. And obviously from, you know, speaking with many of those in those cases, they have made number of inquiries to the employer prior to having come to us. So we know that they're not complying to that level. How many comply after a letter, we couldn't tell you for sure, but I'd have to guess that it's probably a number of them.
That would be a good number to know, and from the standpoint of knowing how badly we need to change the law, how many people are actually have continued to violate the law after they've been notified that they were in violation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Witsit, that probably would, given the fact that the Bureau's had a 33% reduction in staff over the last 10 years, though it doesn't reach the highest criteria for us to go track that. We actually tend to concentrate more on other areas of the law where we actually have more authority and able to create better remedy.
Anything else, Senator Wissett? Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple comments on that last point. Normally in the arena of consumer complaints, I mean, for all the violations, only a small percentage are actually reported to the appropriate government agency, whether it's BOLI or Department of Insurance. There may be lots of wrongdoing. You don't really know the scope of it, but you do know that the complaints are only a small fraction of what's actually going on out there. Is that fair?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, absolutely. I know as a legislator from 1997 to 2003, I actually put in bills on this particular area as well. I had a number of constituent complaints on the very same issue of folks who hadn't even thought of going to BOLI. I actually ended up directing a few that particular direction back in those days. It is one that draws a lot of concern, and if you talk to a lot of attorneys out there, they tend to run into a lot of the same problem. And it's an extreme expense for an employee to go out and hire an attorney, go to court to get the records they should have in the first place that the law says they're entitled to.
Right. Follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Yes. If you look at the bill at Section 1, Subsection 2, it says within 45 days of receipt of the request of an employee, and then the next clause says the employer shall provide reasonable opportunity for the employee to inspect. Do you see that?
Yes, sir.
Well, the scenario that Senator Beyer was describing, where maybe there was a meeting and then another scheduled, another one scheduled, I would think that in that instance, the employer would have provided the reasonable opportunity, and if the employee didn't take advantage of that opportunity, that doesn't place the employer in violation because the employer has provided the opportunity. Is that fair?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I would tend to agree with you. If they provided three or four opportunities for the employee to view those records and they have broken those appointments, they have provided a reasonable opportunity.
So it's not just a matter of whether you would or wouldn't choose to enforce it. I mean, in that instance, the employer would have complied, and if the employee didn't manage to make his appointment, the employer is not going to be held liable.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I would completely agree with you.
Okay. Just a comment, Mr. Chair?
Yes, go right ahead.
I mean, it seems to me that the Section 1, Subsection 4 is, if anything, an effort to provide more latitude for the employer because it gives them a mechanism where it might go beyond 45 days. You could certainly take it out, in which case then the employer would be left with the requirement to comply with 45 days. But this is something that is intended to benefit the employers, not the other way around. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I would completely agree with you. It is that of adding benefit for the employer. If they can, you know, show the employee that there is some difficulty in getting the records and they can come to an agreement, it gives an opportunity to do so.
Right. That way, let's say the employer said, you know what, we sent the records to our storage facility in Kansas, and under normal course, it's going to take us 60 days to get there. But if you want us to do it expedited basis, we can pay a lot of money and get it earlier. You know, what do you need?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, there's also another section in law where it says that for copies of those records, the employer can charge the employee a reasonable price.
Right.
And if they have to go to Kansas, for instance, to get records and expedite it and overnight it, UPS or DHL, they could charge all of those costs to the employee if they don't mutually agree with the employer to extend the time frame.
Okay. Thank you.
Right. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also on subsection 4, I have a hard time visualizing in our age of technology how an employee's records wouldn't be readily available within 45 days. I mean, Kansas won't do it for me. I mean, if they have people working in Kansas, I'm sure, who are capable of have a file and sending it snail mail.
Right.
And so I'm just a little, maybe there's something I'm not seeing here. Are there other circumstances where somebody really would not be able to get records?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, actually it's our own experience at the Bureau that led us to actually think that you needed sort of a fallback position where you could agree to a long period of time. If you have a manager who maintains a personnel record that is out, let's say, on OFA leave or something, and you're not exactly sure where that manager's files are, things like that that do happen in addition to the records being far away in a main office somewhere, personnel records sometimes aren't all stored in one spot. So you do have to kind of go collect them from a variety of managers. So that's a scenario where you could find where you could say, you know, I have this part of your personnel record, but your manager has been out for a while and I need to get her record to make this complete. So, you know, could you wait until they get back from leave? So there's a lot of scenarios that sometimes employers find themselves in that we wanted to provide that flexibility.
No, I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, but if I can follow up, I don't see what the employee's motivation would be to grant an extension. I mean, I guess I don't see the necessity necessarily for this session. I mean, I think it's a good attempt, but I don't know why an employee would, you know, since it has to be by mutual agreement, why they would necessarily want to go along with it.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, a policy decision on behalf of the committee. We were just trying to provide that flexibility.
Great.
Any other questions?
I had one question. I guess this isn't really pertinent to the suggestions for modifying the existing statute, but under Section 1, starting on line 7, it gives the definition of personnel records.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things it says that's not included as part of the personnel records is records that relate to the individual conviction, arrest, or in areas of criminal law. Can you give the chair some, I guess, understanding as to why someone's criminal record that could be, in fact, relied upon by the employer would not be considered part of their employee, the employee's personnel record.
Mr. Chair, I think there's a variety of reasons, and they all go to actually various parts of the law. Arrest records generally are considered not very reliable aspects for purposes if there's not a conviction attached to them. So if you have an arrest record, I think most employment lawyers would tell you that in and of itself isn't sufficient to indict someone and shouldn't be in their personnel records. I know our personnel director will segregate those kinds of things that deal with litigation or convictions in a separate file. To the extent that that information might be helpful for a future employer, obviously those kind of background checks are often done by employers in sensitive areas. So that's my understanding of why those records are segregated out from the personnel records. I could certainly speak to the Department of Justice about why else, what other legal reasons they might be.
Now, I guess my reading of this, it appears that if the employee says, I'd like to get a copy of my personnel records, it says that in this case, those convictions or arrests or investigations that are conducted in constituting a violation of criminal law of the state or other state and within the U.S. are not part of their personnel records. And so it seems like those individuals that are requesting it should have access to whatever's in their file with the understanding of those other exemptions where they got a confidential report from a previous employer or some other type of record. I just wasn't sure why they would exempt them out. I can understand why they could be exempted out from a, let's say, a prospective new employer who wants those, and I think your explanation was geared more to that, but why the employee would not be able to get their own, let's say, criminal history that has been relied upon or part of their personnel file, it just seems to me that something... I'm not sure what the history was for that. So,
Mr. Chair, we'll check into the history of that and get back to you.
Well, it's records that are used for these purposes only, and criminal records would be wrong.
Ms. Hammond points out that the personnel records down below are really the records that are used to address the qualifications for employment versus promotion, that kind of thing. Convictions actually could, for certain types of positions, be a disqualification, certainly. Again, I'm not sure about arrests because I think that those are often suspect for at least employment attorneys' purposes. But we'll look into the history of that and get back to the committee on that.
Okay. Any other questions regarding Senate Bill 138 from the Commissioner? And then I'm going to go ahead and move into questions for Senate Bill 145. And staff is providing us additional testimony from each of the bills. Since this is our first day to hear bills, we're a little green on this, but we'll get it all taken care of until next time you're here. And the chair takes full responsibility for that. So, questions from the committee on Senate Bill 145.
Yes.
Senator Whitson.
Senator Brzezinski, Director Gardner. ORS 657-665 appears to be carefully written to identify or to impose confidentiality of the records. I mean, its use is shall. And the changes developed by SB 145 appear to use language that substantially reduces that enforceability of that confidentiality, if, and so forth. Why?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, absolutely there is a lot of shells in that particular section of law because they actually want to make those records absolutely confidential, much like we do with our prevailing wage survey and the data that we are collecting through the employment department for that data so that no employer's actual hours of man hours that are worked on the jobs show anywhere at all. You know, we're very, very clear on that confidentiality. The reason for that is just that it allows us to speak with the employment department and share those records with them. It still maintains all of the confidentialities and all of the, you know, those records to make sure that they are not public record.
Well, the changes the confidentiality, or it doesn't change the confidentiality. Why do you have to change the language?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, what it is a clarification of current practices to make sure that we, on investigations that we do through the Wage and Hour Division or the Civil Rights Division, can share information back and forth between agencies, you know, without breaching that confidentiality, so that we can do double checks back and forth for their investigations as well. But it still maintains the perfect record between the two agencies and does not make it public record to the general public. It just allows the two agencies to share the information.
Any other follow-up?
Yes, Chairman Pisanski, what happens if the bill doesn't pass?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, you know, we'll continue the current practice. The question is whether we have the protection of statutory authority to do so between the two agencies, which certainly can bring them to the potential of possible litigation in certain circumstances for the actions we've taken. Anybody can challenge it without the clarity in law to say that we have this availability. It makes it a more open point. This just codifies current practices and makes it much clearer in statute and protects both agencies in doing so.
Mr. Chair, Director Gardner, then would you, do you think your current practices are currently outside of statutory authority then?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, no, sir, we don't. But without the clarity, the thing is, anything can be litigated in today's world, I think, as we all know, from any aspect. However, the clearer the statute is, the less the ability for any type of litigation to challenge the question whether we have the authority or not. Therefore, with this clarity, it limits any exposure whatsoever of any potential for argument that we do or don't. We believe that we do. This would clarify it and make it clear to everyone that we absolutely do as well.
Mr. Chair, if you'd like, we do have an example of the confidentiality statement that all employees are required to sign, if you wouldn't want to put that into the record. And as I say, it does say that it's under penalty of discharge. And having worked for the Employment Department before, I know that they take that very seriously.
Well, I guess what I would say, if you want to enter it into the record, that's your choice. And we'll make it part of the record and make it available to all of the senators. And Senator Whitsitt, if you don't have any other questions, I'll go to Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure. So right now, if you call Employment Department and ask for a confidential employment record pertaining to Statute 658.005 to 245 or 658.405 to 503 or anything in 652, 653, or 659A, they will give it to you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, my understanding is that we have to have specific reasons for doing it related to a specific case we're investigating for a specific situation and ask for exactly what it is we're looking for. And we have been sharing records back and forth under their discretionary ability to do so in the statute. And we do share some of that information currently. This just clarifies and codifies current practice. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, if I might, Senator Byer, they do that under current subsection 1 of section 1 because there is a generic ability for them to share with other public employees in the performance of their public duties. So that is where they get the authority now. And the Employment Department staff is also here if you would like any further clarification on their procedure on that.
When we get finished with y'all, we'll call up other potential witnesses.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could Ms. Talbot show me again where they're doing that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, if you look on page 1 of the bill, lines 11 through 13, it talks about the public employee's ability for the Employment Department to share with other public employees in the performance of their public duties. The Employment Department also has a specific rule about the discharge of duties and defining that. That I have just got a copy of, and I'm sure that they will speak to you about that if you would like.
Okay, I think we'll have the Employment Division give us some clarification in a moment. but I want to go ahead and get through the rest of the questions we have from the panel. Senator Beyer, any follow-up?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. I guess it gets down to, I don't know how to phrase it now, because the question would be, what's the problem you're trying to fix? But it seems to me that you're already doing this, but you're seeking statutory authority to do current practice. And that just flies in the face of any time an agency comes to me and says, well, this is what we do, and the statute doesn't simply say we can, but we want to be able to continue doing it, so we want statutory authority to do it. That's what I see this as being now. So it isn't you're trying to fix the problem, you're trying to legalize what you're already doing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, we believe it is perfectly legal to do it. This is a clarification that was asked for by the Employment Department and recommended to us. We do have the current ability to do it. This just gives the absolute clarity of the crystal clear language to show in there. It is, as you read the other statute, perfectly clear that we can do that through the performance of our duties currently as public employees. This adds clarity. And there's many times throughout the statute, many times when I was here in the legislature, we would pass legislation in order to clarify different things within the law.
Mr. Chair, could I ask, could you give me an example of kind of investigation that you would be doing where you would ask for this, and the kind of records you would get from the Employment Department, and how it would hamper your investigation if they said no?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I certainly can. You may be familiar with our Wage Security Fund, which is a good example of when an employer goes bankrupt, employee comes to us. We have a fund that we are able to pay their final wages up to $4,000. And if we are allowed to get that data, we can verify the dates of the employment of that individual, how much money they were making, those kinds of things. In that kind of instance, the employer being bankrupt, it's even more difficult to get their records. So that's a classic example of actually where we need those records the most. In another wage and hour investigation, I understand from Ms. Hammond that we would, in a classic wage claim where someone hasn't been paid by their employer, or there's an example of whether or not the employer even agrees that this individual is an employee, we would look at those records for purpose of saying, well, did that employer actually pay unemployment insurance on that individual, and if so, there's a presumption they're an employee. So we use it to verify things that either party says to us within the course of investigation. It may well support what the employer is saying, it may well support what the employee is saying. It's just another set of information for us to double check on verifying what people have told us. So it is a great source of information to make sure that we can do that verification, and many times it will be a benefit to the employer.
Senator Beyer, any follow-up at this time?
No, not right now, thanks.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee regarding Senate Bill 145? If not, I'm going to ask y'all to stand down and stay close by, because we may need you to come back up on some others. And what I'd like to do is go ahead and ask for other individuals that are here who want to give testimony on bills. We have the witness registration forms here. Since we picked them up earlier, I'm just going to make sure as we go through each of the bills, and we'll kind of get back onto a schedule. Is there anyone here who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 136? And regarding 136, this is dealing with the removal of requirement that contractors and subcontractors pay flaggers state prevailing wage rate on projects regulated by the federal Davis-Bacon Act. And not hearing anyone wanting giving up any additional testimony, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 136. And at this time, is there anyone here? And I believe Mr. Allen wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 137. Mr. Allen, I apologize to you for having you wait through the process. I thought we could streamline this, but the chair is learning as we go. Thank you for being here, and if you state your name for the record and tell us and give us your testimony.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Patrick Allen. I manage the Office of Regulatory Streamlining at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The office was created by executive order of the governor to help state agencies make their business regulations simpler, faster, cheaper, easier to comply with while maintaining protections Oregonians expect for consumers, workers, public health and safety, and the environment. Here to support Senate Bill 137, this is one of 35 bills that form a part of our streamlining legislative package of legislation from agencies to try to streamline regulations. The bills in that package range from large complex policy changes in areas to small incremental changes or improvements to regulations. Certainly this is not one of the kind of bills that's at the large massive policy realignment, but these kinds of bills, by virtue of there being lots of them and lots of incremental changes, can help improve the state's regulatory climate. Basically wanted to take the opportunity of this bill coming before you to let you know about that legislative package. I think you've been distributed now a copy of the various bills that are in it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Allen? If not, thank you very much for your time. Is there anyone else here who'd like to give testimony on Senate Bill 137? Not seeing anyone running up to the witness table, I'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 137. And regarding Senate Bill 138, is there anyone here that would like to give testimony on 138? And again, not seeing anyone coming forward, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 138. And then on Senate Bill 145, I'd like to ask if there's anyone here who would like to give testimony on Senate Bill 145. Why don't you please come up and identify yourself for the record, and we'll give Senator Beyer an opportunity. Maybe it sounds like you may be able to give a little more clarity as to the issues that you've heard.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Tamara Brickman, and I'm the legislative coordinator for the Oregon Employment Department, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have as to the background on confidentiality and the purpose for the bill.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So at this point in time, without this legislation, if someone from the Bureau of Labor Industry calls your office on issues relating to those specific chapters listed in this bill, you would give them that information?
If it's for the purposes of enforcing the law, yes. Currently, under the Social Security Act, which is where the unemployment insurance laws are governed under federal law, we are to maintain confidentiality of information, and they list specific mandatory exceptions for sharing and then permissive exceptions for sharing. And one of the exceptions that they allow us to share for is that we can share with any public official who is acting in their official capacity to actually enforce laws. So if it relates to an enforcement of a claim under which the Bureau of, or the Commissioner would have authority to investigate, then yes, we would share because it's allowed under federal law, and we do have a discretionary statutory provision in our confidentiality laws that allow us to share for that purpose.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Yes.
Have you sought and received on this issue?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Barr, no, we have not.
One more, Mr. Chair.
Right ahead.
Could you give me an example as to the detail or the level of information that you would share as far as what would be contained in that information?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I don't know that I can give you the very detailed, because I don't deal with the requests specifically. I do co-lead our agency's confidentiality team with respect to the general issues of sharing confidential information, and we don't get the necessary detail that's requested, but generally it would be wage records and maybe the address and employment information of the employer and the employee. I believe that would generally be the information that we would provide, but I'm not the person to necessarily answer with specificity what exact records are shared.
Mr. Chair, I think it may be easier, maybe not. As an employer, I know that I have to fill out a quarterly form 132 and a quarterly form, I think it's a QR if I remember right, and then an annual form at the end of the year to reconcile these quarterly forms. Would you if someone was to call from Bowley and ask for the report on employee, you know, X from my business, would you give them basically a copy of these two forms and say, well, there's the last quarter, how many more quarters do you want? I mean, what level of detail are you giving them records of, well, he has 13 employees in the last quarter, or, I mean, well, is there names and stuff like that of employees, or is it just that level? That's what I'm looking for.
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, I don't know the level of specificity, but I'd be happy to check into that and get back to you on that, because I don't handle the requests specifically. They don't come to me, and I don't actually handle whether or not what actual information is disclosed. I make decisions more on whether or not we can disclose that certain information under the law. And the information that we have, we gather through for certain forms that employers do submit, but I don't know that we actually give a copy of that form, or if we tabulate the information ourselves and then just give it to them in another form that we may have, but I'd be happy to check into that for you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right. Any, yes?
Yes,
Senator Wilson.
Chair Przanski, it says here that current laws allow limited release of employment department information. Would Senate Bill 145 change that limit in any way?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsett, no, it would not.
Okay.
Anything else? Not seeing any other questions. Tamara, thank you very much, Ms. Brickman, for coming forward. And is there anyone else, again, that would like to give testimony on Senate Bill 145? And if not, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 145. And the committee is going to take about a 2 or 3 minute break, so we'll go off the record. We're back on the record, and I'm going to go ahead and open a work session for some of the bills that we've just heard public hearing on. So at this time, I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 136 and ask if there's a motion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 136 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Byers moved Senate Bill 136 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion regarding that bill? Not seeing or hearing anyone. At this point, I'd like to go ahead and ask for a vote. And I think for purposes, I prefer having roll call votes at this point. And so, if Karen, if you could be so kind.
Senator Whitsett?
Aye.
Senator Ringo? Senator
Burnett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Byer?
Aye.
Chair Prasad?
Aye. And we'll show Senator Ringo is excused. And that Senate Bill 136 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And do we have any volunteers who would like to carry 136 to the floor?
Sure.
Senator Byer will be the carrier for that bill. Thank you very much. He wanted to give someone else an opportunity to get the first one out of our committee. And at this time, I'd like to go ahead and open a work session on Senate Bill 137. And ask if the chair would entertain a motion regarding Senate Bill 137.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 137 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byard moves Senate Bill 137 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Not seeing or hearing any. At this point, I'll go ahead and have a vote.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Senate Bill 137 is passed on the floor with a due pass recommendation. Open a work session now on Senate Bill 138. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Senator Burdick will be the carrier on 137. We'll open a work session on 138. And the chair again will entertain a motion.
Chair.
Yes.
I would move Senate Bill 138 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byers moved Senate Bill 138 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is any discussion at this time?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. I'd just like to say that Senator Ringo pointed out the provision on lines 11 and 12 that alleviated my concern with the scenario that I presented where an employee who has all the incentives to not hold a meeting or see the records. But I think that language does alleviate that concern. I still don't see any way, shape, or form, number four subsection will ever be used,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think it hurts the bill. I think it is an opportunity or an attempt at flexibility. I think it would be a better attempt if it was stated something to the effect of that, you know, if for some reason, you know, somehow to give the employee an incentive to use subsection four rather than not use it would be better. I don't know how that wording would be, but I think, you know, in my opinion, 45 days probably is a reasonable time. And,
oh, great. Thank you. Any other comments? If not, then Karen, if you'd call the roll, please.
Senator Whitsett?
Aye.
Senator Ringo? Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Vice Chair Byer?
Aye.
Chair Pazonski?
Aye. And again, Senator Ringo will be shown as excused. And Senator Whitsett, would you like to carry this one before or not? I'll be glad to carry it if you don't prefer not to.
That's fine.
All right. Senator Whitsett will be our carrier for this bill. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 138. We are not going to go into work session this time on Senate Bill 145. I think there's been some ballot questions that have been asked, and I'd like for the Bureau to please get back to us with that information. And if you want to schedule individual appointments with any of the senators, feel free to do so. And then once we get the information back, we'll bring it back for a possible work session and schedule it appropriately. With that, I don't believe there's any other business for the committee unless committee members have anything for the good of the order. If not, then was there anything, Anna, that
maybe
we needed?
Maybe next meeting, say what we're going to be doing.
Just for clarification, we are supposed to have a meeting that's going to be both as a joint meeting for the first part with the Senate General Government regarding the issues in insurers medical examinations. And if everything comes to pass as we had hoped that it would have today, but it turned out that one of our witnesses was not available, if everything works, we will spend approximately the first hour of the meeting with the Senate General Government. There will be an informational presentation from some of the individuals that are involved with that issue. And at that point, we will proceed on some additional bills that have been posted for our committee. And the General Government, I assume, will go back into their own meeting since they meet at the same time. So I'm going to ask the committee members. I know that all of us are in Judiciary. I'm looking at, based on our timing and stuff, it sounds like we'll probably won't be able to get started until 5 or 10 minutes after 3, but if we can kind of get here, maybe we can go ahead and get this expedited and we can get out of here on a timely manner. Thank you very much, and with that, the Senate Committee on Commerce will be closed until our next meeting scheduled for next this coming Thursday. Thank you.